Welcome to Lectionary at Lunch. I'm Dr. David Adams, and this week we will be examining, as our Old Testament lesson, the prayer of King Solomon found in 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 4 to 15. The first two chapters of 1 Kings recount Solomon's struggle to secure the hold on his throne after the death of his father David. So the account that we have before us today presents us with the first noteworthy event of Solomon's reign. And it is presented in such a way that it holds out for us the potential of Solomon's great reign and the foreshadowing of the doom that will befall him and his kingdom after him. We turn now to 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 4. Vayelech HaMelech Gibonah, Valizroach Sham Kihi Habamah HaGadolah. The king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, because it was a great high place. In the verses just before this, we learn in verse 2 that sacrificing in high places was commonplace in Israel at this time because there was no temple, and that Solomon participated in this practice. This is described in verse 3 as a flaw in the king's devotion, given that sacrifices at high places had been previously prohibited by God, especially in Deuteronomy 12. Solomon is said to have traveled to Gibeon. In the text, the word Gibeon, in the Hebrew text, has a hey directive. Gibeon, or modern El Jeb, is located about 8 miles northwest of Jerusalem, just into the territory of the tribe of Benjamin. The name means hill place. The site is a small hill surrounded by fields, and it has been clearly identified by jug handles with the name of the place inscribed on them. Now, Gibeon was quite an important site in the early history of Israel. You may recall that Joshua and the Israelites were tricked into making a treaty with the inhabitants of Gibeon, and subsequently they fought a famous battle to defend the Gibeonites from retaliation by their Canaanite neighbors. During the course of this battle, God made the sun stand still, as is recorded in Joshua chapters 9 and 10. Several times the great pool at Gibeon is mentioned in the Bible, almost certainly a reference to the substantial water system dug deep into the rock to give access to an underground water supply and to provide storage. The text describes Gibeon as Bama Gedolah, a great high place, and this description raises several questions. Clearly, the site was an important religious center in the early history of Israel. The tabernacle was located there during at least part of David's reign, and several other references in the pre-exilic period suggest the cultic significance of the site, which is echoed in the words of this verse. The fact that no cultic structure has been found in the limited excavation of Gibeon raises the question of the nature of a high place. Some biblical references suggest that high places were hilltop sanctuaries, and interpreters often describe them as open-air gathering places, perhaps associated with a cultic tree or standing stone. While there is certainly biblical evidence to support this picture, there's also biblical and extra-biblical evidence to suggest that man-made cultic structures in urban settings were also called high places. So it may well be that the term high place is used in a more generic sense for a place of worship that can be applied to a variety of settings and structures. In any case, the text continues, Elef aloth ya'ale shalomo al hamizbeach hahu. 1,000 sacrifices, or burnt offerings, Solomon offered up upon that altar. Presumably, the text is not trying to tell us that the king offered up 1,000 sacrifices during the one visit that is described there. Moreover, we must ask whether the text requires us to understand that Solomon himself acted as priest and performed the sacrifices with his own hand, a thing for which King Saul was condemned, remember. I'm inclined toward the view that the text means that Solomon probably authorized and perhaps paid for sacrifices to be offered up in his name as king on a regular basis by the Levites or other priests who regularly officiated at Gibeon. In this way, Solomon could easily offer up 1,000 sacrifices without having to make the arduous journey round trip from Jerusalem to Gibeon every few days. Verse 5. Begibeon nira Yahweh el Shalomo b'chalom halayla. In Gibeon, Yahweh appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. This is very common language used to describe this type of revelation, so there's nothing particularly extraordinary about this phrase. Vayomer Elohim sha'al ma etten lach. And God said, ask what I will give to you. This is one of a number of places in the Old Testament when God appears and invites someone to ask for something from him. Perhaps the closest parallel to this passage is Isaiah 7:11, where God invites Ahaz to ask for a sign. Here the phrase might be literally rendered, ask what I will give to you. But this is idiomatic language, and the sense here is more along the lines of, ask for whatever you want, and I will give it to you. Verse 6. Vayomer Shlomo, ata asitha im avdecha David avi chesed gadol. And Solomon said, you have acted with respect to your servant David, my father, with great grace. Solomon says that God has acted im avdecha David, with your servant David. The im here and in the next clause does not indicate the idea of companionship, but the idea of acting in relation to someone else. In BDB, this is meaning D under the entry for im. God's dealings with David are here characterized as chesed gadol. The term chesed is always difficult to translate, but it communicates the idea of steadfast, unmerited favor, hence the translation by grace here. The ESV uses the phrase steadfast love for this term. Ka'asher halach lefanecha ba'imeth ba'tzedakah ba'yishrat lev imach. When he walked before you in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart with respect to you. The clause begins with the compound kasher. This compound is often used in the sense of just as, but it's used in several other senses as well. It's also used in an explanatory sense, translated because. And that's the way that many English translations take it here. However, I prefer the temporal use, when, because the point is not so much to establish a quid pro quo in God's relationship to David. That would run contrary to the implications of describing God's actions as chesed gadol, great grace. Thus, the temporal sense, when, fits the context a bit better. We continue. Vatishmalo eth hachesed hagadol hazeh. And you have maintained this great grace toward him. Vatitain lo bin yoshev al kiso kayom hazeh. Since you have given to him a son sitting on his throne to this day. Here the wow that begins the clause is circumstantial, or perhaps explanatory, given the circumstances that explain the preceding statement. The fact that God has kept his promise to David and maintained the ruling dynasty that he promised the king is a sign of God's gracious favor. But it's important to note that this is a promise to David that is the important thing. Preserving the line of Davidic kings is not a sign of divine approval of those kings themselves. It is an act of faithfulness toward David. This is underscored in the last phrase, Kayom Hazeh, as on this day, by which Solomon cites the example of his own reign as a sign of God's faithfulness to David. Verse 7, Wa'ata Yahweh Elohai, and now Yahweh my God, Solomon now turns to answering God's request. Ata hamlakta eth avdaka tachath David avi. You have caused your servant to rule in the place of David my father. Here, tachath is not used in its most common sense as a local preposition that we would translate under, but rather in the sense of in place of or instead of. The verse continues, Wa'anoki na'ar katon lo eda tseith wavo. Even though I am a small lad and do not know how to go in and to go out. Here the initial wow introduces a circumstantial clause. In the context, this is perhaps best translated concessively, even though I am a small lad. This last phrase, na'ar katon, creates something of a translational problem. Most English versions follow the King James translation of this phrase, something like, I am but a little child. While this is certainly within the scope of the words, and is perhaps the simplest translation, it's rather misleading here. If you follow the biblical chronology, Solomon was somewhere around 20 or 21 years old at this point. No one today would think of a 21-year-old as a young child. And frankly, they would be even less inclined to think that way in Solomon's times than we are. In Solomon's times, the average lifespan was quite a bit shorter than today. In the Bible, the Hebrew term na'ar could signify a male anywhere between a prepubescent boy to a full-grown young man. Now, whether Solomon was exaggerating his youth and inexperience as a way of showing his humility, or whether he actually thought of himself in this way, in either case, some phrase like small lad or little child is probably misleading to the modern hearer, and it would be better to translate something like young man instead. Verse 8. Wa'av deka batok amka asher b'charta. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you chose. Amravasher lo yemane velo yesafer merov, a numerous people who cannot be counted or numbered because of its vastness. The verbs yemane and yesafer are niphals. The last word merov is a preposition min appended to the noun rov, indicating a numerically large amount of something. The min, from, designates the reason for the statement. We have the same idiom in English as, for example, when we say something like, he died from cancer, the from indicating the cause of his death. Verse 9. Wanathata la'abdika lev shomeah. So give to your servant a listening heart. The Hebrew lev shomeah is slightly problematic. The words are simple enough, and I translated them here literally, a listening heart. Obviously, the word heart is used figuratively here. The question is whether to translate it in such a way as to imply an attitude, in which case heart is probably a good choice for lave, or whether to translate it in such a way as to imply ability, as in something like an understanding mind. English translations vary, and you can make a good case either way. I'm inclined toward the attitudinal option, since the context is mostly about Solomon's attitude, but either choice would be defensible. Whether Solomon is praying for attitude or ability, the purpose for his request is clear from the next clause. Lishpot Eth Amka, Lahabin Bein Tov Lara, to judge your people, to understand between good and evil. Ki miyukal lishpot eth amka hakaved hazeh. For, or perhaps because, who is able to judge this your great people? The verb yukal appears to be a hofal imperfect, but most grammarians follow Gazanius, who himself is following the medieval grammarian Kimki, and regard this as an unusual development of the call. The meaning is clearly not passive, and the fact that this verb does not occur outside the call apart from these imperfect forms suggests that Kimki may be correct. The phrase, Amka hakaved hazeh, this your great people, sounds a little clumsy to the modern English ear, but it is about the only alternative that does not involve dropping one word or another. Verse 10, Vayitav hadaver b'enei Adonai, and it was good in the eyes of the Lord, ki sha'al Shlomo et hadavar hazeh, that Solomon had asked this thing, or perhaps for this thing. Verse 11, Vayomer Elohim Elau, then God said to him, Ya'an Asher Sha'alta Et Hadavar Hazeh, Ya'an Asher, because you have asked this thing, Walo Sha'alta Laka Yamim Rabim, and you have not asked for yourself many days, Walo Sha'alta Laka Oser, and you have not asked for yourself wealth. Walo sha'alta nefesh avoyecha, and you have not asked for yourself the life, or nefesh, life of your enemies. Walo sha'alta lacha habin lishmoa mishpot, but you have asked for yourself to understand, to hear justly, or to understand how to hear justly. All of this long verse is just the explanation of what is to follow. The wow that begins the last clause is adversative, so we translated it but instead of and. Also, the last word, mishpat, is a noun, justice, that is used adverbially here. To hear justice means to hear justly, that is, to hear in a just manner. This use of a noun as an adverb is quite common in biblical Hebrew. The next verse now brings us to the conclusion that follows from this long introduction. Hine asitha kedavereka. Behold, I have done according to your word. Hine nathati lekalev Chokma v'navon. Behold, I have given to you a heart of wisdom and understanding. The last word, navon, is a nifal participle from the hollow verb being, used as an adjective modifying heart here, an understanding heart. Asher kamoka lo haya lefanecha. The tricky thing about this phrase is the use of asher. We most commonly encounter this word as a relative pronoun, translated which or that. But here we have a relatively rare use of this word as a conjunction. In this case, a conjunction used to introduce a final or result clause. See Kaler Baumgartner all the way at the end of the entry for Asher, section B, subpoint F, for this. For other examples, you can check out Gazanius' Hebrew Grammar, paragraph 165b. Also in this phrase, the word order of the Hebrew sounds a little clumsy in English, so we probably should adapt the word order as we translate this and translate it something like, so that there has not been before you, we'd probably stick in the word anyone like you. The thought is finished in the next phrase. Va'achareka lo yakum kamoka. And after you, there will not arise another like you. Verse 13. Va'gam asher lo sha'alta. And also, that for which you did not ask, nathati lak, I have given to you. Gam osa, gam kavod, both wealth and honor. Asher lo haya kamoka ish bamalakim kal yamecha. Here again, asher is used as a conjunction to introduce the final or result clause. We would translate, with the result that there will not be like you a man among the kings all your days. Verse 14. Wa'im telek bidrachai, and if you walk in my ways, lishmor kuchai wa mitzvothai, to keep my statutes and commandments, ka'asher halach David avika, just as David your father walked, wa ha'arakti eth yamecha, then I will lengthen your days. Here, hifiel from arak, to make long. In the last phrase, the wow introduces the apodosis, the then part of a conditional if-then sentence. This is a normal and common use of the conjunction wow in biblical Hebrew, and it's the most common way that the then clause of a conditional sentence is introduced. Verse 15, Vayekech Shlomo, then Solomon awoke, Vahine Chalom, and behold, it was a dream. Vayavo Yerushalayim, Vayavo Lifnei Aron Barith Adonai. And he went to Jerusalem, and he stood before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Vayaal Oloth, and he offered up burnt offerings. Vayaas Shalamim, and he made peace offerings. Vayaas Mishte Lakol Vadal, and made a feast for all his servants. That ends our translation. Before we wrap up, we should add a few observations about preaching this text. There is an ineffable sadness about this passage. On one hand, the reign of David's son begins in the best possible way. Solomon was born into a rich and powerful family, a prince who would one day become king. He had the favor of his father, the love of his mother, and the respect of men. God had kept his promise to Solomon's father David to ensure an heir of his house would sit on his throne and establish a ruling dynasty that would last forever. And Solomon becomes king because of God's promise to David. Solomon recognizes that one of the keys to being a good king is the obligation to administer justice impartially and with wisdom. So he prays to God for the wisdom to fulfill his calling as God's king. Now he prays for wisdom to carry out the duties of his office wisely and well. God not only grants him this blessing, but since he prayed for something that would benefit others and not for his own benefit, God chooses to bless Solomon even more, promising him honor and wealth and power. Yes, Solomon's reign begins well. And yet the shadow of his doom looms over this passage. It stands as the merest hint at the beginning of verse 4 and in the last words of verse 3, foreshadowing Solomon's downfall and failure, despite all the benefits of his human position and the blessings of wisdom from God. For despite all the blessings that God had given him, Solomon disobeyed God, First, by promoting worship at the high places like Gibeon, and later by allowing, even promoting, the worship of other gods. Yes, God gave to Solomon great wisdom so that he was the wisest man in all the world, and he still fell into grievous sin. Even the greatest of wise men are fools in the sight of God. And human wisdom, whatever its measure, is not enough to gain the kingdom of heaven. For that, only the foolishness of God will do. The foolishness that repents of sin, trusts in Jesus Christ, receives his promise of salvation, and rests in his grace. In this way, the story of Solomon's wisdom points us to the way of our salvation. As Paul writes to the Corinthians, God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And because of him, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. If only Solomon had possessed such wisdom. I'm Dr. David Adams, thanking you for joining us for this week's lectionary at lunch as we have examined 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 4 to 15.